Hello, welcome to the All Out for No Loss podcast. This is Vasant Kumar, and along with me are my co-hosts, Anand Kumar Sankaran and Ramakrishnan G. Iyer. In today's episode, we will be talking about the final test of the BGT that was played in Sydney over the new year, and also a little bit about the overall series and what's the road forward. We went into Sydney, 1-2 down in the series. The message was very clear. We win, we retain the BGT, and we are still in the hunt for the World Test Championship final. One would think in such a situation, the goal of the team would be to put together a team that will play with a more positive outlook and a stronger bowling unit. Instead, we were faced with a whole bunch of backroom garbage, with press conferences being handled by the coach and lack of clarity until the morning as to whether the designated captain will play. It reached a point wherein all of us were looking at Cricinfo or Cricbuzz to find out who was coming out for the toss. Very sorry state of affairs, very reflective of the state of team in terms of planning and strategy and whatnot. The game itself was pretty exciting thanks to a very, very juicy wicket, which incidentally was deemed satisfactory by the Mandarins at ICC, quite shockingly. A green top that helped the quicks all through the game. There was little or no role for any spinners, which also made the decision of the Indian team to play two spinners all the more mystifying. And the fact that they hardly bowled in the game made things look even more silly, just a reflection of the muddled thinking that was going on with the team management. We got rolled for 185 on day one, but then there was a fight back. Even in the absence of Jasprit Bumrah, the others chipped in, and we managed to take a small first innings lead. But by the end of day two, that four-run lead was frittered away with some very ordinary batting and, of course, a lot of outstanding Australian bowling. And we were barely ahead, about 140-odd ahead at the end of day two, with four wickets to go. The third day belonged to the Australians completely, as our remaining four wickets fell in very quick succession. And then there were about six overs of mayhem when our opening bowlers bowled probably the worst spell of bowling one could have ever seen. Something that you don't even see in high school cricket. It was that bad. And by the time they were done, they'd given Australia a 40-run head start in a chase of 160 as they sauntered to victory. A pity that a good series and opportunity was frittered away. Of course, we'll always be second-guessing as to what would have happened had Jasprit Bumrah been fit to bowl on the last day. We'll never know. But let's face it, Australia were on top for the better part of the game, except for some small stretches, and they did deserve to win. Thoughts?
Lyon bowled a total of four overs in the first innings, and he was not called to bowl at all. I actually want to go back and see how many times an Australian spinner did not bowl in an innings completely at ACG. That should be some kind of a statistic or a record. I don't know how ICC determines if a pitch is bad. I think they only go by up and down consistency of the ball. I don't think they consider lateral movement at all. This pitch in particular, pretty much everybody panned, starting with Michael Clarke, for whom the ACG is a home ground. So pretty much everybody said this was an unplayable wicket and nobody should be actually playing cricket. I did read that they changed the grass that was used for this wicket for whatever reasons, and only one Sheffield Shield game had been played before, and chasing 160-odd, Tasmania was all out for 68. So kind of an unknown wicket to start with. So even more puzzling was the press meet that Gambhir gave after the test was over, where he claimed that they consciously went in with two spinners, the two of them who together bowled 10 overs. And I think they bowled 10 overs because Bumrah walked away in the middle. They probably wouldn't have even bowled that. Truly bizarre selection in a series of truly bizarre selections. This test in particular was pretty bad, given all the drama with Rohit and Gill and everybody. But my memories of this test would be Pant 1 and Pant 2. Pant 1, who apparently wanted to prove after the MC first and second innings dismissals that he could bat by not using his bat in the first innings. And he was hit 12 times all around his body. And then, you know, he couldn't resist that shot at 40 that got him out. But this time, you know, Sunny Gavaskar was not as mad at him, perhaps because he's taken 12 blows to his body. So how can you complain? But in the second innings, Pant really showed what happens when his mind is free. I don't know how he decided that he's had enough. And that was just spectacular viewing. You got to really admire Pat Cummins. Every time when his team needs him, he figures out a way. Very quickly, the field settings and the bowling went from a test match to a T20 game when Pant was batting and Cummins basically got Pant out. In a way, he would dismiss him in a T20 game. And towards the end, it petered out. It was pretty sad to see us collapse on day three. I thought we would score at least 30, 40 more runs. I don't understand why Nitish Reddy checked his shot, but it's what it is. I don't think it would have made a difference. Another 30, 40 runs without Bumrah, I don't think any number of runs would have been enough. But I do keep wondering, even in the absence of Bumrah, if Akash Deep was playing as well, we really had gone with four bowlers. There was something there in the wicket for them to exploit. We'll never know. Bad selection for perhaps the fifth test in a row. And we got lucky once. We got lucky twice with the rain. And the end of the series reflects our team selections.
In a test series that was full of bizarre selections, the bizarre set of selections in Sydney literally took the cake. You mentioned the presser that Gautam Gambhir did at the end of the test. And there was this other presser that he did at the beginning of the test when he went out of the way to explain to the journalists that they would make a choice on their playing 11 after looking at the pitch. We all know what the pitch looked like. It was green. And then in his infinite wisdom, he decides to pick two bowlers who were going to bowl spin simply because they can bat. Right, that's effectively what he did. Not that it helped, because you know our totals in the first innings was 185 and our total on the second innings was 157. So it's not like it's really solved the problem, and the Indian team managed to get to a decent 200 score at least once because they had packed 1 through 9 with batters. They were basically solving for a problem that was just not there to be solved. They could have instead doubled down, picked that additional bowler. Like you said, Anand, around Akash Deep, it's probably not going to be Akash Deep. We found out that Akash Deep does not have the fitness to bowl 3 consecutive tests ago. He gave up after test 2. So we would have probably brought Harshit Rana back. But that said, even Harshit Rana would have been a better choice than one of the two spinners, Jadeja or Sundar, take your pick. I don't have an opinion. But they missed that trick big time. To me, in summary, the fact that the Indian team lost the series 3-1 does not rankle. I think it is a real reflection of the difference in capabilities between the two teams. But the fact that the Indian team never put their best 11 on the field to compete as hard as they could or they could have is what really rankles. It is, to me, a series of missed opportunities. Some of the tests ran close. The Melbourne test did run close. And there were occasions where India were in the hunt. They could have possibly even won the game. And perhaps better team selection could have seen them through. Who knows? And if that had been the case, that would have been a wonderful accomplishment, because this is a good team. But we did have completely new fast bowlers with single-digit experiences as it comes to bowling in test games. We were batting with two aging stars who are basically over the hill. And then we had a bunch of newbies, Nitish and Jaiswal, who were playing for the first time. So truly never knew how they would respond, but they both responded really well. And then there were these intermediaries, the KL Rahuls and the Shubman Gills, on whom we bet a lot. We thought they'd do well. They had history and nothing. Rahul kind of flattered to deceive, started on a high, slowly pitted out. Gill literally got 3 chances, played once, played twice, got dropped, came back, didn't do much. That, to me, was effectively the story of the lost PGT. So 10 years, they held on to the Border Gavaskar Trophy. So I do feel bad about that.
I was thinking that the scoreline reflects the number of bowlers each team had.
Actually, we should, you know, take a moment to appreciate how good the Australian bowling attack was. We were lucky that Josh Hazlewood played 2 tests. If Boland had played all 5, I really don't know how one-sided those games would have been, right? 3 tests, 21 wickets. Pat Cummins was Pat Cummins. He was simply mind-blowingly good. And Stark, he did get hit a little bit by Rishabh Pant in that magical second innings, but otherwise he was super steady and extremely good with the new ball. And we were lucky that they did not have the services of Josh Hazlewood in one of the tests, which kind of allowed the Indians to go a little scot-free. But what a brilliant bowling attack.
I would tend to agree with you. I mean, they bowled very, very well. And mind you, Michael Nesser was not fit. And that would have made an additional impact. And honestly, at Sydney, there was every chance that they might have dropped Lyon and played four quicks. Had Nesser also been available or Hazlewood been available. But again, what rankles is not the 3-1 scoreline. I think if you go back to the beginning of the series, we might, more out of emotion than anything else, felt that India would hold their own, win, draw the series and so on and so forth. But on paper, this team was not there. We knew right from day one that our bowling resources were suspect, with Shami not being there and the rest of them being relatively new. And in the lead up, Siraj was bowling poorly in the series in India. But what really rankles is that this was an opportunity that was thrown away just by bad strategy. If you go so defensive, you're right out of the gate going with the mindset that I will somehow try to draw and see whether I can sneak one through. That was never going to happen in a 5-test series. And then when you go into the last test, when your only way out is to win the game, how can you put up a team like this? The only spinners who are going to play are people who are of the elite variety in the likes of Lyon, Ashwin and so on. No run-of-the-mill spinner was going to play. There was really no reason to play Washi, period. See, Jadeja is batting beautifully in tests. Jadeja is always plus 15 on the field with his fielding. Washi simply was not going to be of much value in spite of that 50 that he scored in Melbourne, the rearguard action. So I think they missed a trick. Played Harshit. But I'll go one step further, go back a little bit. I thought this Indian team didn't do their homework very well. Number one, Sam Constas. Everywhere the message was the same. Bring the ball in, the guy is going to get into trouble. No, we did not. We let him seize the initiative on day one of Melbourne and constantly be under our skin. An early dismissal on that day would have muted everything. And then this whole business of who's going to play. They play one guy in Perth. And in reality, another guy would have been better suited. In Adelaide, when the ball was moving around so much, there was little doubt then Akashdeep should have been playing.
Correct.
And then again, in Brisbane, it was one of those hit-the-wicket-hard situations that benefited from Prasidh. And for heaven's sake, even Mukesh Kumar would have been very, very good in Sydney. You didn't need the pace. Boland was bowling just a little more than 130. That much Mukesh Kumar can do. And Mukesh Kumar is accurate. Problem we have is that Prasidh Krishna has a tendency to be expensive.
Correct.
So playing both Prasidh and Siraj is a challenge. Well, you can play one. But one thing is crystal clear. Be it an Indian fan slash podcaster slash analyst slash follower of cricket, be it somebody from the Australian podcast world or an Englishman, there was one thing that was common. That India blundered in their selection in Test 5. The presence of that extra seamer might just have made all the difference. Instead, these guys just flogged Bumrah so much that it was just a matter of time when he was going to break. Some guys are of the opinion that the Australians knew fully well that Bumrah is going to break down at some point of time. Why are questions not being asked of the team management on this one?
Little bit about Washi. In the Gabba Test of 2021, Washi bowled 31 overs in the first innings and 18 overs in the second innings. In the first innings, he bowled the maximum number of overs. Australia batted for a really long time, and I think they batted for 115 overs. Washi bowled nearly a fourth of all those overs at the Gabba in not necessarily a spinner-friendly track in the first innings. If you really picked Washi as a spinner, why not let him bowl? Like, he never got to bowl in any of these tests. Maybe in one test, he had a spell of about, you know, 8 overs or so. It was very comical. If you can, with a straight face, say that you pick the spinners intentionally, then you should bowl them, right? Or is it something like, you know, the captains don't trust him? And I'm talking three captains here, not just Rohit Sharma. I mean, it was Rohit, Bumrah, as well as Virat Kohli at the SCG. That's like three captains who don't seem to trust his bowling. The whole thing is really bizarre. I thought, like, the team and as a viewer, I missed Bharat Arun as the bowling coach here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Australia made 369 batting first. Marnus Labuschagne, 108. In that innings, Washington Sundar bowled 31 overs for 3 wickets, including that of Steve Smith. As you say, he bowled a lot. But this is a flat track that really had nothing, right? So, and the Pacers, by the way, also bowled a lot. I mean, Siraj bowled 20 overs in the second innings and 28 overs in the first, which is as high as what Bumrah ended up bowling, 53 overs at the MCG.
I will grant one thing. The wickets on this tour were nothing like the wickets in the last piece. They were much more flatter. They were more conducive to bowl some spin. I mean, forget the Indian captain. Look at Lyon. Lyon didn't bowl much except for that second innings in Perth.
Yeah.
And he was also a bit of a passenger for the Australians. So I can understand why our spinners didn't bowl. But I can understand why one spinner didn't bowl. I don't understand why pick two spinners and suddenly you have three bowlers. And then suddenly one gets injured. Then you've got two bowlers. And these guys were out of gas by the time they were done with their first spell.
It is disappointing. But that said, I think Anand's point that the scoreline is reflective of the number of bowlers they both had, I think it's a pretty good summary of where this all stands.
It's a perfect summary. It's the best summary I've heard, because we can talk about so many things, but let's face it, their batting was as bad as our batting. Their fielding was as bad as our fielding. And even the strategies were a little wonky on both teams, worse from our side. The real issue, three bowlers versus one bowler.
So speaking of their bad batters, kudos to Usman Khwaja for coming up with this new verb called "I got boomerad" in his effort to sort of justify how he was averaging 6 against Bumrah for the course of the series. I thought was really funny. I mean, he just apologetically said, "Well, I had the job of facing Bumrah and I was not up to it. I got boomerad each time." It was really very nicely done.
Yeah, it is very easy to say all these things when you win the series. I don't think he would have said any of this stuff had they lost the series.
If they had lost, he would have been dropped. He would not have been going to Sri Lanka. I mean, no. The team was announced today and he's on it.
But to me, what I think was the turning point of the series is a strange one in my view. It was on day one of Adelaide, all out for 180. They were batting. It is the twilight time. The ball is supposed to be doing all sorts of things. And
they survived.
Had we breached them that day, had we taken 4-5 out that evening, we might have won that match. And had we won that match, their team would have been in shambles, because the external entities, their media and ex-cricketers and everybody else, were absolutely giving them a shellacking after Perth. Nathan McSweeney was so courageous that night to take that score to 87 for 1. In the morning, we quickly got them to 105 for 3. But then by that time, the first Bumrah, we had reached that 40-over mark and the ball was starting to do less and had landed, turned up at that time. Had we breached earlier like we did in Perth, we could have got them in a lot of trouble in Adelaide. And that would have weighed heavily on them, because one thing is going into a match when the series is 1-1 or 2-1 up. The other thing is you're already trailing 0-1. You've got everybody at the gate trying to do and give you a lot of pressure, calling you the worst Australian team ever and so on and so forth. The Australian media actually said, oh, this is going to be a 3-0 or 4-0 win for India after Perth. That 87 for 1, I still feel so bitter about that segment where when the ball is doing so much at night, our guys didn't convert. One more bowler that evening to support Bumrah and we would have had them.
The big turning point for me in the series was the dropped Jaiswal catch at, was it 98 for 6 in the Melbourne second innings. I still wonder what might have been had that catch been held and how differently the game could have gone from there. So that would be my turning point. As it turned out, we allowed them to get to 200 plus. There was a 10th wicket stand of 50 plus. And then the match was gone, basically. But imagine the scenario where, you know, India was chasing somewhere between 180 and 200. I mean, yeah, they showed that they did not have the ability to get to 200, like in seven of the 9 instances, I think. But who knows, if there was a win staring at them at the end of it, could they have stretched that batting lineup to get to about 200? I think about that in my... It might have been a situation.
I would have picked the 3 catches that Jaiswal dropped. But since you have since you have talked about that, I think another turning point was us saving the follow-on in Brisbane. Because without that, we would have probably been 4-1 down in all likelihood. Because, you know, we were not going to cross 185, 190 if we had followed on. So I think that was a positive-ish turning point because I think that's what set us up nicely for MCG. But three things with Bumrah stood out for me in MCG on day four and later on in day five. Day four, first, there was the snippet that went around where Rohit Sharma is cajoling Bumrah to bowl one more over and Bumrah is refusing him and say he can't do it anymore. And then there's a beautiful photograph where on day four, the umpires call time. The 10 other Indians have left. The two batters are leaving. And then Bumrah is standing mid-pitch, holding his knees completely wiped out, staring at the pitch. And then the famous third session where the collapse has started after the second punt fiasco with Bumrah holding his head, sitting in the dugout. And I've never seen him that way because he's always tearful. And these things happen back to back. So it was all kind of foreboding to ACG and what would happen to him. And I really hope that it's minor and it's not another stress fracture or whatnot.
That is the one that worries me the most, Anand, right? We have heard nothing about what exactly has happened to him. The official version that came from Prasidh Krishna at the presser was it is a back spasm. The last time he reported a back spasm, it turned out to be a stretch fracture of the back and he was out for 2 years.
That is why, like in the last podcast we recorded, I said, you know, I don't remember the last time Bumrah played five tests because they've, for good or bad, they've been managing his workload very well. And this time they ran him to the ground.
Yeah,
which again is because we picked, you know, our team management wanted 10 batters. That's all it is. Right, Vashi has no business to be batting at 9 and Reddy has no business to be batting at 8.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And, you know, these people are constantly covering the failures of the top 3 batters. You know, 3 of the top 4 batters. I shouldn't see the top 3 or 4 of the top 5. But that's what it is. Yeah, I really don't know. I really hope Bumrah comes back.
Honestly, I'd trade the Champions Trophy for the England Tests. I'd rather have him play the Tests in England. Champions Trophy is going to be played in Dubai. Bumrah is not going to make that big a difference in that series compared to, say, the England series. In the Champions Trophy, Ashdeep and a few others can manage. And if Shami is fit, we'll be fine.
My worry is that, you know, the PR machinery will swing in and they will want to make this the swan song for Roe and Co. And they will therefore go all in to try and figure out a way to win the Champions Trophy. Which means that Bumrah may not be given the option to opt out. He would be forced to play, assuming nothing has happened to him and is available for the Champions Trophy. The problem I feel is if he's going to be fit, he's going to be forced to play. I truly hope that's not how it is.
Even if he goes quasi-fit, they make him play. What's worse is the IPL after that. His franchise might just force him to play. And that's going to be another problem.
Yeah, we have to worry about those scenarios as well.
Given the track record of the NCA medical staff with Shami, I am really, really concerned about the health of Bumrah and when his real return to play will happen. But overall, I think we are all in agreement that the 3-1 scoreline was really not terrible. It was reflective of the team's relative strengths.
Pretty much.
At the end of the day, just some poor calls and insufficient number of personnel to perform certain tasks.
Yeah, and the one test we won, you know, Bumrah bowled so many magical spells. His first innings burst in Perth is so far ago, and it's not even his best spell in the series. But that's what won us the test. He just blew away Australia in about 45 minutes to an hour.
67 for 7. That first ball wicket of Steve Smith made such a difference because this guy sticks and drags things along.
The fellow then went on to make 200s, by the way.
Before we move away from this topic, I just have one question to both of you. And I'll also give you my opinion. Now that we know who the WTC finalists are, who do you think is likely to be the favorite on paper at this current point of time on current form? Of course, a lot can change before June 20th.
The man with the 88% win rate, Vasant. The captain tracking to an 88% win rate.
Well.
This is my favorite too. I think Themba Bavuma has led the South African team with flair through this cycle. They knew exactly how the cycle was and who they needed to win against. They sacrificed the series against New Zealand, backing their ability to win at home against the weaker sides. And they did. And they are in the final. I mean, jokes aside, I think Australia are clearly a stronger team and they are likely to win. But it would be nice to see someone, you know, get in the way of these invincible Australians, Pat Cummins and his team, and try and go for an upset. So I'll be rooting for South Africa to win, though I find it unlikely that they will actually win.
And the last time South Africa toured England, I think South Africa won at Lords by an innings, if I remember right. And it was a Bardar show back then. The next two tests, at Old Trafford and in the Oval, England won comfortably in both times. If I remember right, it was the whole thing was Rabada. Rabada was all through the series, he was on like supreme form. Given that this game is going to be played at Lords, I think it's 50-50. It's going to be very hard to beat this Australian bowling lineup, which has won everything. I think it's going to be a shootout of the bowlers. I think it's going to depend on who's the third fast bowler for South Africa.
They have many.
They have a lot of choices.
They have been rotating people around and they've been very comfortable. There's this Bush guy. And of course, there is Vian Mulder. There was some other guy.
The young 18-year-old kid.
Yeah, they rotate their quicks a lot. They have a lot of them.
The fast bowling unit that, by the way, won the last test in Lords back in 2022. What Kaiser Rabada, who took a fifer in the first innings. And then there was Lungi Nigidi, Andre Gnokia, and Marco Jansen. Those were the four fast bowlers they used in the last test at Lords. They have lots of other options, as it turns out.
Talking of South Africa, one has to talk about Pakistan also. After a meltdown, there was a heroic attempt to overcome a 400-run deficit, and then they failed. The bargain, they managed to collect 5 penalty points. The West Indies win one game of the two tests, Pakistan will finish 9th. It's astonishing how poor they've been this year. Yeah.
And they also had this really unfortunate incident with this guy,
Sai Mayu.
He ended up breaking his ankle. So that was...
Yeah, that is a pity. I mean, that kid was really, really playing very well. And then, boom, they have this situation.
Kudos to the captain, you know, Shaan Masood, for showing up under pressure, making 100.
I like the guy a lot. He's very solid. He's solid, head on his shoulders, very balanced the way he talks, the way he does stuff. He's, I mean, one of the more wiser leaders.
Hard to not like him.
You're right. The next two tests to the other end is the two tests in Gaul. Well, Prabhat Jayasurya will do whatever it takes to take down the Aussies, but it's academic interest.
I just want Sam Conscious to have like a black face. And then that is all I look for. I mean, as far as the outcome of that series is concerned, it's been taken out of the equation.
I am very excited by the return of Todd Murphy. I like that guy's bowling a lot.
Pat Kuhneman is also back.
I have one last thing to say, Vasant, since you said Pakistan. Can there be a perfect farewell for Roe and Co other than playing a test at Rawalpindi?
That would be nice. If India does qualify for the final, I don't know what the final arrangement is. They'll probably play the final in Dubai at that time, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. There's no Indian team will not go to Pakistan to play anything in the foreseeable future. So
also think of it this way, Ashwin, for you, Anand, right?
I'll take that.
The guy never played a test in Pakistan.
With that, we have come to the end of this episode. And after this, we are going to be moving from red ball cricket to white ball cricket. There is an England versus India 6-game series, 3 ODIs and 3 T20Is coming up starting from later this month. And then it'll be followed by the Champions Trophy, which is being played in 2 countries, Pakistan and the United Arab Emirates. And then the Indian Premier League, which follows. So there's going to be a lot of white ball cricket following all of this. And yes, there is one round of Ranji Trophy where apparently all our test veterans have been asked to go and play. And some people are asking Gautam Gambhir also to go and do some coaching at the domestic level before he tries to retain his job as the national coach. With that, thank you, everyone.